When we talk about the history of a building, we're really talking about the history of the people who use that building. So first, let's talk about the building, then we can talk about the people. The Temple of Israel at 4th and Market Streets is one of the most distinctive structures in downtown Wilmington. With its Moorish Revival design of arches, onion-shaped domes, and beautiful stained glass, the temple was built in 1876 and is believed to be not only the oldest synagogue in North Carolina, but also the 10th oldest synagogue in the United States that's been in continuous use. As with all old buildings, maintenance is an ongoing issue, and the temple's small congregation of about 200 families has struggled to keep up in recent years, putting the future of the nearly 150-year-old building at risk. Services have not been held there since early 2020, just before the pandemic began. Last month, the congregation announced a $500,000 fundraising campaign to make much-needed repairs. And I'm happy to say that, so far, the campaign is going well. Thanks to an anonymous $100,000 donation that came in recently, the temple is halfway to its goal, which means that it's well on its way to being preserved for future generations. Certainly, the Temple of Israel is an integral part of Wilmington's history, but its history also offers a fascinating look into the history of Jewish people in Wilmington. Some family names from the temple's early years: Bear, Bleedenthal, Jacoby, can be found in Wilmington to this day. This is Cape Fear Unearthed, the podcast exploring the legends, historical oddities, and landmark stories of southeastern North Carolina. I'm your host, John Staten, and I'm a reporter with the Star News here in Wilmington. We're a Gannett paper that's part of the USA Today network. My guests today are Glenn and Beverly Tedderton, both longtime members of the congregation at the Temple of Israel. Beverly is the president of the temple's board, and she's also a historian who ran the North Carolina Room at the New Hanover County Public Library's downtown branch before retiring. Glenn taught history and German in New Hanover County schools for 27 years before he retired. And last year, Beverly published a book, The History of the Temple of Israel, which is both exactly what it sounds like and much, much more.
Okay, I am sitting here in the downtown Wilmington home of Glenn and Beverly Tedderton. They moved in about 1981. So Glenn and Beverly, thank you for being on Cape Fear Unearthed. Yeah, so I just, I've been reading your book. Beverly just has just published a book last year. Well, what number of book is this for you? 7, 8, 10?
Quite a few.
It's called The History of the Temple of Israel in Wilmington, North Carolina. And the Temple of Israel, of course, is at 4th and Market Streets, and it was built in 1876. And the book is fascinating in that it's about the temple, but it also, of course, gets into the history of Jewish people in Wilmington and of, you know, Wilmington itself. And as me and Glenn were talking about just a second ago, the temple dates to the 1870s, but there were Jewish people in Wilmington dating back to as pretty much as far as we have recorded history almost, right?
Right. The first Jews here were, one or two at a time,
right,
and mostly Portuguese or, you know, Iberian Jews.
Okay.
If you know where the Lazarus house is.
Yeah, I do.
The Lazaruses were Jews.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
And that house is a little over 200 years old.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So it's a long, history, obviously. And then as you write in your book, in the middle 1800s, and then especially after the Civil War, more and more Jewish people started moving here. Kind of tell us about why, what kind of prompted that, you know, Jewish immigration into Wilmington.
Of 40 founding families, 39 were German, and they were mostly Bavarian. And before unification of Germany, Bavaria had very restrictive rules on what Jews could do. Most of them lived in small towns. There could only be so many married Jews in those towns, and they couldn't just pick up and move to Munich or Nuremberg because there were restrictions on that too. So for young Jewish men, one of the things they could do was go somewhere else.
Right.
Also, the economy was changing. English industrial fabrics was damaging to the rural economies of Germany because they did textile work, and
right,
they couldn't compete with cheap factory cloth from
right,
England. So the whole rural economy was kind of yeah.
So they moved
depression.
To Wilmington for sounds like for economic reasons, also social reasons.
Well, in Wilmington was the center of transportation for North Carolina and part of South Carolina, and there were opportunities here, and so the Jews were moving here from the middle of the century on from Germany.
Yeah, and so well then, as the number of Jewish people in Wilmington began to increase, eventually they're going to want to have a house of worship, right? And that just naturally follows. And so Beverly, talk a little bit about. I know that there was an early congregation that maybe folded or didn't.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that and how you know the Temple of Israel, as we, you know, the building kind of came to be.
Just 6 months or so.
It didn't last very long, about 6 months. And there was only one person on that organizing committee for that synagogue who remained, and they would meet at his house, and then eventually more came, and they decided to form or to build a synagogue. But even earlier than that, the earliest Jewish presence is the Hebrew cemetery at Oakdale.
Right, okay.
And right after Oakdale was built, they bought a section, which is still called the Hebrew cemetery.
Okay, wow.
And so that, you know, what Jews do is before you do anything else, you have a cemetery.
Right, okay.
Do you know why?
I don't know why, but I would love
to. Well, to have a synagogue, you need 10 living Jews, but to have a cemetery, you only need one dead.
Okay, so that makes sense. Now, that is fascinating. And then, at some point, they started meeting, and they're like, well, we need to have a building. We need to have a building just like, you know, the Christians do, or any other religion where we can all gather and, you know, worship.
Yeah, synagogue means, or comes from Greek, but it means assembly. And the Hebrew is Beit Knesset, which means house of assembly, because it's a public, for public worship. You can worship at home on your own, but
sure. Well, and then this is fascinating to me as well, is that, not to say that, you know, Jews weren't discriminated against, because as we were just talking about, they didn't get the right to hold public office in North Carolina until after the Civil War. So clearly there was discrimination, but at the same time, in some respects, they seem to have been accepted into the kind of larger community in Wilmington.
Yes, they were very well accepted. You know, they had in common with the German Jews that belonged to the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church. The Germans, they were Catholics and Lutherans. They ate the same food.
Yeah.
They listened to the same music, and so they did surround themselves with other Christians.
Yeah.
And they seemed to be fairly well accepted.
The men were mostly in fraternal lodges.
Yeah.
So that was a big, Masons or Knights of Pythias. Right. There were lots of lodges then, because it was before TV.
Right. That's what you did for entertainment.
And, there were lots of reasons, economic and social, that men joined.
And it seemed like it was less segregated. I think, obviously, white and black in Wilmington was segregated very much at that time, but it seems like maybe less so with
Jews
white.
Were recognized as white.
Right. So you could have a store downtown next to the other stores, right? And it was...
So, in the South, race always had a big role, but when a group is recognized as white, they're relatively free to move around among others.
Right. Well, and then another thing I was realizing as I'm going through your book is a lot of these names I keep seeing, like some of the people that helped, form, start the Temple of Israel, Baer, Jacobi, I think Bluthenthal is one of those in there. And those are names we still see around Wilmington
actually
today.
It's pronounced Bluthenthal.
Bluthenthal, okay. All right, thank you.
Just the way it's spelled.
Yeah. Right. Well, I was here called Blumenthal, and I knew that wasn't right, but that's another name that pops up in there as well. But
Blumenthal Airport it was called Blumenthal Field. But then there's also the Solomons, the Sternbergers,
Fishblade
Katz.
Fishblade was the first Jewish mayor.
Right, and that was in the late 19th century, right?
Right.
So, Yeah, and then so let's get so the temple was actually built. And I love the Moorish revival style is it's pretty exotic even for today. And I'm sure at that time it was really the building stands out today. So I'm sure at that time it really was something different. You know, that Wilmington had not seen that type of building.
The architect Samuel Sloan had designed First Baptist and the previous First Presbyterian, the one that burned in the 20s.
And a bank.
And a bank downtown. So he'd already done three buildings, and the bank has some Moorish elements.
Yeah.
He also designed the Octagon House in Natchez, which was in True Blood. It was used as the home of the Vampire King of Mississippi.
Well, I thought you were
And but, so he did some other Moorish things. He was a very well-known 19th century architect from
And also there were more there was a big connection between Wilmington and Philadelphia because of the shipping, and there was a very famous Moorish style temple in Philadelphia.
And Sloan lived in Philadelphia.
Right.
I'm the architect,
Well, then the Moorish style was popular in the 1870s. Yeah. There were a lot of them in Europe and others in North America. There's just not many left now.
And, so then I love this part of your book, Beverly, and maybe you can talk a little bit about how you found some of this stuff, but they talk, when they finally, they did a groundbreaking, and it was a big deal, it sounds like. They had a parade, they had, music, they had people talking, they had a cornet club that played cornet was, that was pretty, in the 19th century, a brass instrument was probably pretty, pretty fancy, so it was a big deal, it sounds like. From the very start.
I did a lot of research in the temple records, and I've also done research in national records in Cincinnati, where the Jewish archives is. But to be honest with you, I got a tremendous amount of information from the local newspapers.
Yeah. The Star News and over at the library, the North Carolina room where
there were other newspapers here at that time too. A lot of it came from the newspaper in what we call Rosenthal Hall, which is the basement of the temple.
Mm-hmm.
We have a large clipping from the Star News of the day of all that information, and it tells you exactly what happened. It was so important to Wilmington that they put it on a full thing on the front page.
Wow, and that is amazing, and wouldn't you love to just to be able to maybe time travel for a few minutes and just go back and hang out?
Yeah, I gave a lecture. It was our 140th or whatever. Anyway, and I just got everybody to try to imagine what, if you were a woman, what would you be wearing?
Yeah.
What music would you hear? Who sang? And I know exactly who sang.
Yeah.
And, just trying to imagine gentlemen's clothes, what the children were wearing.
That's right.
The ladies had bustles.
Oh, wow.
And they wore a lot of clothes. They weighed about 40 pounds when you're fully dressed.
Yeah. And then this is maybe kind of a side note, too, but it's always been a reform temple from the first days, right? Is there a particular reason for that, why it started as a reform?
Well, the previous congregation had a cantor who was the leader, and he wanted to members to close their stores on Saturdays because it's Shabbat.
Right.
But Saturday is market day in the South. That's when the farmers come to town. And it created a great deal of tension, which is one reason that the congregation only lasted a few months.
Right, okay.
So the reform movement was more adept at dealing with that kind of economic reality. And almost all the Jews who lived here at the time were businessmen.
Yeah, they're business
had
people.
Dry goods stores and clothing stores and shoe stores, and they needed to be open on Saturdays.
Right, right.
Well, so the reform movement fit in with the rural Jewish community or the small town Jewish communities at the time very well.
Yeah. When you, Beverly, doing your research, who are some of the, are there any personalities or individual people that really kind of stuck out, that kind of, you know, made an impression on you just for whatever reason?
Abram Weil. And there were Wheels here later, but his name was Abram Weil. And the congregation was formed at his house on 4th and Orange.
Wow.
And so he called...
block or two from where we're sitting right now.
And he called the group together, and that's when they organized the congregation, which was in like 1871.
Yeah.
So the congregation has been around, and then it was at that meeting that they decided that they were going to try to raise the money to build a synagogue. But he also, he was very active in moving around. His son went to Chapel Hill. He was the first Jewish valedictorian at Chapel Hill. His son went to prep school in Cincinnati at Hebrew Union. So he was very, very familiar with the Moore style architecture.
Okay.
Yeah, Plum Street Synagogue in Cincinnati is still there, and it's Moorish style.
So the congregation actually formed in 1871. It took them 5 years to get the building built. But, and that's
Pretty good for 40.
That's pretty good. And I think you said in there, so they raised $20,000, about $20,000, which is about $500,000 in our inflated dollars of today. And I think you told me before, but Beverly, it just wasn't local people that were donating or just Jewish people. They got donations from over the state, from non-Jewish people in Wilmington.
And Germany.
Oh, wow.
Because these German Jews, you know, they still had connections to their families in Germany. And they wrote back to Germany, and they said, we're trying to do this. And so they got funds from their home families. And then some of them say they had cousins in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And they sent money. Cousins in Savannah.
Yeah.
Charlotte, whatever. Or not Charlotte so much. Maybe Raleigh. But
right.
Or
Goldsboro.
New York.
Right.
Yeah, the other Jewish settlements in North Carolina were extremely small then.
Yeah.
But there were a lot, you know, the men were all in lodges, and their lodge brothers contributed as well.
Well, absolutely. And then I think I'm not sure that we mentioned this earlier, but when this synagogue was built, it was the first in the state? I guess it's the oldest in
Charleston.
The state. Yeah, there's one in Charleston, South Carolina.
One in Richmond, and maybe Norfolk, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But
In Savannah.
Yeah. So they were mostly port cities, and Wilmington was not as easy a port to get to, so it was a little slower in developing than, say, Savannah or Charleston.
But even today, it's around the 10th oldest synagogue in the United States, is that right?
In
continuous use.
There are some older ones, like in Providence, Rhode Island. Right. In fact, the one in Durham, which is probably the second...
In Durham?
Durham, that they fixed up.
Not in Durham. Goldsboro or Statesboro.
No, Greensboro.
Greensboro, yeah.
And so that congregation does not meet there.
Right.
But they have built a new campus outside, but they continue to have it. You know, they have weddings and bat mitzvahs and special events there, but their congregation's too big for it.
Yeah.
But ours, we are one of the oldest in the country that has been in continuous use. Yeah.
And that's just fascinating to me that it's been, you know, because we've seen so many houses of worship churches that are now they're event spaces or now they're not, you know, churches anymore.
The average synagogue lasts about 80 years.
Yeah.
But then with demographic shifts, when, you know, the populations move to other parts of the the area.
Yeah.
It just makes it harder to keep going. But in Wilmington, particularly with the developments in Leland and surrounding areas in Brunswick County, our congregation is right back in the center of the community.
And there's about, you said there's about 200 families today that are part of the congregation. What was the, is that the most it's ever been, or like, or is there a certain point, there's a,
oh, there's
a,
been
a height of...
We've been,
membership.
It fluctuates because people move in and out, and some people check out permanently.
Sure, they do.
So, it was much smaller when we joined in the 80s.
Yeah.
Then when the interstate came, things picked up more. So, but we have members from Chocowinity to Myrtle Beach. And because we do a lot on Zoom and Facebook, they can participate. And that COVID's really increased our use of that kind of technology. Yeah.
And the White Bull Synagogue is closing.
Oh, wow. Okay, I did not know that.
They only have 8 members.
Okay.
And they've closed.
Yeah.
And they are supporting us. They're going to give us a lot of...
Yeah. That's great.
And then the renovation.
And then they have become members.
Some of them. And some have joined B'nai Israel or in Myrtle Beach. They, you know, the congregation, there's only 3 Jews still living in Whiteville.
And then, well, so maybe talk about, you know, we can talk about some of the, you know, what are some of the, as you've done on the research in the book, what are some of the highlights? You know, what are some of the things that you remember, you know, because obviously it became, you know, central to the community early on. What are some things that kind of happened over the years that that were significant?
The role of women increased.
Yeah.
Our daughter was the first woman to say the blessing over the wine.
Oh, wow.
It was traditionally something that men said. And she was a teenager when she did that.
Yeah.
So, you know, women... The role of women has increased, and Beverly's the 4th woman president since we've been members. And so that's a change in the movement. We just celebrated 50 years of women rabbis in our movement. But you know, when it's 50 years for the whole movement, it still takes a long time to filter down to a individual synagogue.
Well, and then let's talk a little bit about what, you know, actually, let me step back a second. What was the last time that, you know, what was the last in-person gathering you had at the temple before COVID and before?
Just before things shut down, we invited Marcy Cohen Ferris, who taught Southern food courses at Chapel Hill, and she also had a course on Southern Jewish food. And so we invited her down. We took some of her recipes and some other Jewish recipes we had, and we had a big dinner.
Her book is Matzah Ball Gumbo.
Oh, wow.
And so she came down and gave a talk, and we filled our hall at the Reedman Center, and she gave a talk at the temple. So that was... almost the last thing we had. We had one more Shabbat after that, and then things shut down for COVID.
Yeah.
And we've met a few times over at the Reedman Center since then. But
And then, well, let's talk a little bit about the building itself, because you know, it's an old building. You guys live in an old house. I live in an old house. And they require a lot of upkeep, and upkeep is not always cheap. And it's usually never cheap, honestly. But you started, I guess last month you guys started the public fundraiser, trying to raise $500,000 for repairs to the temple. Now from the outside, it looks good. You know, even from the inside, the stained glass is still there and beautiful. The I guess you call them the domes on the top of the, is that the right term?
Yeah.
The domes still look beautiful. Now, along the side wall along Market Street, it looks like there is some damage. Tell me a little about what has happened and kind of what you guys would like to see when you are raising money.
Well, Florence damaged it a lot, but insurance paid for it, and we got some donations, okay. and we were able to get back in the building.
Yeah.
And then Dorian came, as you remember. Yeah. It was not a huge storm, but it created some damage at the temple.
Yeah.
And then COVID.
Yeah.
And then looking at the damage to the temple, yeah. I found that there was a lot more that was not related directly to the storm.
Okay.
And so that's when it became
In terms of like a foundation,
problem.
Or is it like a...
Well, there's some foundation problems. Yeah. There's water intrusion problems.
Yeah. And there's drainage.
And drainage. The drains from the roof are not big enough. At the time, they were fine because the trees weren't big.
Right.
But now the trees are taller.
Right.
And so it's created some serious problems. And we had a clean-out spout, and they could go down to the... couldn't go. They didn't have a way to get up. And so
the
block drain, it's just created.
Okay, so the trees are blocked the drains, and you get it, and it's hard up into the big roof. It's hard to get up there.
Yes, there was damage that was not detected right away. We've done renovations over the years.
Yeah, sure, of course.
And we've spent a lot of money, but mostly the money came from within the congregation.
Yeah.
So this time, the board said it's too much for the congregation to bear that cost alone. So
well, and I know that we had
a public fundraiser.
Yeah, and I know that it was kind of floated out there. Well, maybe is it time because you have the Reubman Center up a few blocks up Market, so you have that, and now it was maybe discussed. Well, maybe is it time to sell the building? Was that ever seriously discussed, or was it more just board, maybe we need to consider it out of
The board was considering options.
Yeah.
And selling it was an option, but we don't think it was in sellable condition.
Yeah. And that's I would think that would be almost like a drastic move, right? Because that's part of the Jewish heritage.
Drastic.
And that would almost be like if you would have no other, that maybe that is like you have no other choice.
Although if you look at Preservation North Carolina, there's often a downtown church somewhere that's moved. And so it's not an impossibility, but it would certainly be a great sadness for a lot.
Well, it seems admittable, and the good news is the fundraiser seems to be going pretty well.
It is.
Yeah. Now, what are you?
Although costs have gone up.
And they always are. I just thought it was fascinating that the $500,000 is almost the same in terms of
as we've
talked about. It was built for $20,000, which in today's money is $500,000. So now, it's funny and. And they were also fundraising back then, just like you're fundraising today?
We're also going to have another phase for maintenance.
Okay.
So, and we actually don't know how much it's going to cost, because once when you get into your house,
I can only imagine it's never cheaper, is it? It's always more than you thought.
We considered selling our child.
Yeah. But
we didn't think we'd get that much for her.
and Glenn, I have to ask you about this too, because I've always loved this story. And I don't know, I have no idea if this is true. I hope it's true. If it's not, it's still a wonderful story. But as you know, and you've probably heard this story of the domes are, now they're painted gold. I had heard a story, I think from Tony Rivenbark, was when of Thangan Hall. And Claude Howell lived up in the Carolina Apartments for years, and he would look down. I think part of his view was, the temple. And at some point, maybe in the past, those domes were not painted gold. And he saw they were doing some renovations or some painting, and he went down there. He's like, it sure would be nice if those domes were painted gold like they were when I was a boy. They're like, oh, that would be nice. Apparently, they were never painted gold when he was a boy. He just thought they would look nice gold, and they do, absolutely. So I don't know if there's any truth to that story. Have you ever heard that story? I just thought it was
Tony spent a lot of time with Claude,
yes.
but we did too.
Yeah.
When we were so poor, we would hire a babysitter every Tuesday night and go see Claude.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that was our big entertainment.
he was very entertaining.
And Claude would sit there and he'd say, look at the domes. I've even got a Christmas card that he... Yeah. He used to make his own Christmas cards, and he gave it to me with the temple domes. I'm sure that he had his eye on it, because he had his eye on everything.
Right.
But I can tell you, when we had a renovation And they did need painting.
Yeah.
Ed Terberg was hired, and Ed said, you know what? Let's go to Rippey Cadillac. And he got gold Cadillac paint, and that's what they used to paint.
Wow, that's amazing. And they've been gold ever since. This is probably in the 80s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, I can't remember another
early
poem.
90s,
80s.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure.
If you look at the cover of the book, and that is an original watercolor.
Yeah, they're kind of goldish
orange. It's from 1890.
Orange. Yeah, they're kind of burnt orange, maybe. If people don't know, Claude Howell, of course, was an artist in Wilmington for a long time. But so moving forward, what do you see? You know, I guess ideally, you know, 2, 3, 5 years from now. You know, where do you see the temple? Because you have, you know, on the Rehman Center, you can meet there and do, you know, synagogue activities there. What do you see the role of the building
We'd like to use the building more than just Friday evenings. Wilmington's destination wedding city. And so
I've been to a wedding there, and it's been
We'd like to, you know, be able to rent it more for weddings.
Also, I mean,
but you know, for our bar mitzvot, mitzvot and other special events,
and the high holidays too. But also, I've taken probably thousands of people through that building.
Wow, no, I believe it.
On tours, you know, we got a call last week. A person who's doing a Netflix series called us up and said, "Could you show me the temple and the Hebrew cemetery?" And we took her around.
Well, it would be a beautiful. It would be a beautiful. I don't know. I assume stuff has been filmed in or around there.
Rabbi Sidlovsky, last rabbi, was in a film doing a wedding, a Jewish wedding there. We told him he didn't look rabbinical. He was only in for about 30 seconds.
Right. Well, it is. I mean, it is God.
But
I mean,
it was in the building.
It is very historically significant, just because of. I mean, it's got the beautiful arches and the stained glass, and the domes, and I mean, it's just a beautiful building.
And at the news conference, I think it was Rob Zappel, who said that he has always thought of the temple being right in the heart of the historic buildings, because you've got Thalian Hall down the street, you've got the Bellamy, you've got St. James. And these large, mostly public buildings are right in the heart of the historic district. And also, of course, the Burgoyne Wright House down the street. So
it's part of the fabric of the community. And that's one of the reasons we were able to get a lot of donations from this neighborhood.
We also got donations from former members and families in Greensboro, Winston-Salem, Charlotte.
Well, that is just wonderful to hear. And as people, you know, like you said, people have a lot of love for this building and this congregation in this town. So I think it's, you know, that says a lot that that people are willing to, you know, give, like you said, when they don't even live here.
Yeah, so, we've been helpful in times, too. When Front Street Methodist Church burned in the 1880s, we invited the Methodists to come to the temple for Sunday.
Yeah.
And they did for 3 years while they were building their new church on Mulberry Street.
Huh.
And they named it Grace, and the street name eventually changed, too.
Yeah,
when that one burned, they met at the Lutheran Hall while they built the one they have now.
Well, so Mulberry is what Grace Street used to be called.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so what else should we talk about the on the temple? What is, you know, if you guys have been going there for so long, what's a good memory you have of it, or being in services there? Just anything that happened there?
There's so many, but of course, you know, when you have a child, everything you've done with children, my daughter was married there, there's just some great, great memories. Like, for example, a former rabbi did a service every once in a while called Invite Your Neighbor.
Oh, okay.
And people, you know, like Bob Jenkins, you know, the famous tour guide, Bob called me up and he said, I've been dying to get in that building and I'm dying to know about Judaism. Yeah. So not only did people come, number one, to learn about Jewish faith, but they came because they wanted to go in the building. I've taken congressmen through here, and they would say to me, I've been driving by past this place all my life, and I've always wanted to go in.
Yeah. Well, Beverly Tetterton, Glenn Tetterton, thank you so much for your time and for talking with Kate for Unearthed about the Temple of Israel.
You need to be over there in 5 minutes.
And that's it for this episode of Cape Fear Unearthed and our look at Wilmington's Temple of Israel. We'll be back soon with another chapter of Wilmington history. Till then, make sure you're a member of our Facebook group where listeners can ask questions about our episodes and share their own memories of the region's history. In that group, I post extra content from each episode and links to all my coverage of local history for the Star News. You can find that group by searching Cape Fear Unearthed on Facebook. Don't forget to sign up for the Cape Fear Unearthed newsletter that goes out every Thursday. Sign up for the newsletter at starnewsonline.com/newsletters. Cape Fear Unearthed was written, edited, and hosted by yours truly, John Staten. You can find more of my work at starnewsonline.com. Additional editing was done by Adam Fish. This podcast is made possible by listeners and readers like you. Support local journalism and Cape Fear Unearthed by subscribing to the Star News today at starnewsonline.com/subscribe. And you know what? While you're subscribing to things, be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you stream this show, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review, which will help even more people find Cape Fear Unearthed. Till then, get out and explore the Cape Fear region on your own. You never know what you might unearth.